Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast with Kate Donovan.
You deserve more than feeling constantly fried to a crisp. Welcome to Fried, the Burnout Podcast, where you get the understanding, the community, and the information you need to end burnout for good. I'm your host, Kate Donovan, and all of my work focuses on hashtag ending burnout culture. Outside the pod, you'll find me on stages at conferences giving keynotes, in offices providing corporate trainings, doing virtual VIP one-on-one work, or supporting our group program, Unfried, that is run by my right-hand woman, Sarah Vosen. Both Sarah and I have been through burnout and came out stronger, happier, and more fulfilled, and we want that post-burnout growth for you, too. Friends, I don't know how I got to be this lucky, but I happen to have people in my community that are so absolutely mind-blowing, that have things like many multiple books in many multiple languages all over the world, have podcasts with millions of downloads and people following them everywhere, have keynote speakers that are just smashing it all the time. So this is actually Andrea and I met because we ended up.
And she couldn't be on the show today, but we brought Andrea.
Yeah, exactly. That woman is not available, but today Andrea Owen is here, who is a keynote speaker, life coach, author, and hellraiser. I can definitely confirm that that's true. Andrea Owen is creating a global impact in women's empowerment with her books being translated into 19 languages and available in 23 countries, which is so incredibly impressive. She helps high-achieving women maximize unshakable confidence, master their mindset, and magnify their courage. You can learn more at AndreaOwen.com. I met Andrea at a speakers conference. We ended up being roommates, last minute, random, out of nowhere. We spent so much time laughing, even though we were both like, don't talk to me that much in the room. I'm not really. And then we talked nonstop.
Impede a little from laughing so hard.
Yes, exactly. And so I'm just, first of all, thank you for being in my orbit.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you for coming on this show. Today, we always start with the guest burnout story, and I know that you have more than one to tell. Guests have been asking recently about divorce and grief and all sorts of that stuff. I know you have stories around that. And we're going to talk about Fried Fam. Get ready for this. We're going to talk about increasing your resilience when it comes to the feeling, the state, the emotion of shame.
The experience of shame.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So we're going to really get into it today. But first, as we always do, we're going to start, Andrea, with a story from your life. And I'm going to let you pick whatever one you want.
I'll pick the most recent one because it's the most fresh in my mind. So you know, you mentioned grief and divorce. I think this story starts technically in 2016 when I lost my dad. And it was the first, I think it was a poignant death in my life because it was a parent and I had never lost anyone before that. And so the universe really handed it to me in that regard. And I think like many people, I had a complicated relationship with my father. So there was a lot of the grief was, I mean, just typical grief, I think. And then after that, I had a really great 2019 was my most successful year in terms of revenue and my business success. But then when the pandemic happened in March 2020 is when things really started to fall apart. So, and I think it was a perfect storm. The grief from losing my dad was still very prevalent. My marriage was not great. And then we went in to try to fix it. And you know, to be fair, my soon-to-be ex-husband and I gave it everything that we had, and I'll be forever grateful to him for that. And we went to the ends of the earth for each other to save the marriage, but it started falling apart around, I would say 2021. I also started to have symptoms of an autoimmune condition, which took 18 months to get a proper diagnosis. I kept getting the, you know, it's the typical, which I'm sure you heard so many times in this work that, you know, your labs look fine. There's some borderline stuff, but it's probably perimenopause. You know, in 2020, I turned 45. So I was like, you know, reaching that point and also perimenopause. So it was a lot of variables were happening. So it was hard for me to really point to burnout. Cause I'm like, well, it's my age. You know, my doctors kept telling me that. And so all of those things combined pushed me to really have an immense lack of motivation in my business. What used to bring me so much inspiration and fulfillment and joy was making me feel like I wanted to pull my teeth out. Like I remember saying one time to a colleague, I would rather have my teeth pulled out from a drunk dentist than launch another program or write another book. Like, you've got to be kidding me. Oh, and then I had a third book come out after I had huge success with my second book that really fell flat. And so it was all this rejection and just really difficult times, I think, that again created that perfect storm to burnout. And I, even though I've done so much work on myself, both personally and professionally, as what I teach around self-compassion, having all of the rejection and the personal hits was just too much to bear. It was too much to bear. I was beating myself up, you know, saying things like, I'm better than this. Like, look at what I have done. If you look at my resume and my bio, like, it's impressive. I look at it, you know, and just, I'm like, wow. I mean, Kate, I have had success beyond my wildest dreams. People are like, so what's next for you? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, I haven't surpassed what I ever even remotely dreamed of or had goals around. What do I do next? So it wasn't until I got my Hashimoto's thyroiditis diagnosis and then finally got on a treatment plan that worked. So I could, to the brain fog started to slightly disappear and I could sort of see everything that was in front of me. I was like, oh, this is my biggest burnout to date. And then I was able to have that self-compassion, which I think is so important in burnout recovery. And so, yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
So I want to, because I know a little bit about your earlier history, I want to create a fuller picture for people, because sometimes people say, oh, you have people on your podcast and they're already so successful and I don't have access to resources the way that they do. And I don't have, can you tell people a little bit about where you came from, what your growing up was like, what, you know, what your background is? Because I think that sometimes when we're behind a mic, people, we only show certain things, right? Because that's part of what we're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
And people airbrush us also in their minds.
100%.
Yeah. So can we remove some of the airbrush that might be in people's minds because of all this crazy success that you've had?
Yeah. Well, I mean, from the very beginning, I came from working class parents. I think that the immense privilege I had from that was, of course, I had, you know, a roof over my head and never went hungry. And also my parents, at least during my childhood, were very loving and more or less consistent emotionally. It wasn't until later where that shifted and was very disorienting for me. In my adult relationships, I was married previously. So this is my second divorce. And in my first marriage, he and I had been together since I was 17. We were very close. I was very close to his family. And right around the time we were discussing having our, you know, trying to conceive our first child, my then husband had an affair with our neighbor, lived across the street, and got her pregnant instead of me. And it was, to date, the most traumatizing thing I'd ever experienced. I wanted more than anything. And I was 30 at the time. Like, I wanted more than anything to start a family. I very much was that type of person. And so I was devastated beyond even what I could recognize at the time. And I immediately started dating, which I, in retrospect, should not have done, but it's what I chose to do to try to heal my broken heart, and ended up with someone who in just under a year had pretty severe mental illness. And he was a con man. He truly was, conned me out of thousands of dollars. Lied about having a terminal illness to cover up a pretty severe drug addiction. And I ended up pregnant with his child, did end up having that baby. When I don't say that, I get DMs like, did you have that? What happened? Don't leave us hanging. Yes, that child is 16. He knows his origin story. And then my second husband ended up adopting him. And it did end up, you know, kind of working out for a while. My second husband and I did have a great run there for a while. But I had a lot of trauma that I hadn't even processed, you know, from those two back-to-back very dysfunctional relationships that were traumatizing. And so that was also, I think, part of this more recent burnout.
Yeah. And do you put the like initial book success and then book flop in that story too, because that's a heavy thing.
You mean like a heavy pill to swallow with all of that? Yeah. Elizabeth Gilbert has a TED talk about that and just creativity and the pressure of topping your biggest success, especially as a creative. I was for sure feeling that when I walked into that third book. And yes, it was, there's also a lot, to be fair, there's a lot of variables that happened.
Of course.
That was a pandemic baby book. It came out in summer of 2021. It was my first hardcover book. I took a slight deviation around topic. So we've tried to unpack why it didn't do as well. But I do wonder if a lot of it was the state that I was in when I wrote it. I still 100% believe in the content. I do. I believe it's my best book. It's my best work. But energetically, where I was at when I wrote it, I was on like a wobbly bridge. That's the part I wonder about. Like if my reader could almost feel it before they even decided to buy it.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah. And along the way, you were one of the lucky ones that was able to study alongside Brené Brown, which is just incredible. And that's where a lot of this sort of work around shame and things, right? This is where a lot of this comes from. And the reason that when we started talking about what you might talk about on the podcast and you said, well, we could do shame resilience. And my whole body was like, oh my God, how have we gotten so far and not done an entire podcast on that? Like, how is it possible?
Yeah.
Like what, because we talk about it consistently, like in the first, I think, 3.5 seasons of the podcast, in the introduction, I said, this podcast exists to help you eliminate the blame, shame, guilt, and self-judgment that comes alongside burnout.
It's a big word to throw
like,
around,
it's,
Kate.
Right? Yeah. Like it's, and it's right there. And it's been part of the mission and part of the idea the whole time, but I don't know that we've spent a lot of time talking about it directly, aside from saying that if you can come into this space of the podcast and feel a little less alone and start to understand that it's not your fault, then some of that shame can sort of drop off.
Mm-hmm.
Because shame likes to hide, right? Shame is a solopreneur.
100%. And it likes to be insidious, like definitely behind the scenes. It's like a ghostwriter almost.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so
like to be named.
When you started digging into this information, what was it that kind of struck you about it first? When you were like, okay, yeah, I'm going to like, yeah, yay, Brené Brown. Yeah, I'm going to learn about shame. Like, let's jump in. What was the thing that you were like, oh, shit?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I'm glad we're starting here. So I found her work actually in 2009. And I was getting a little bit concerned about my drinking habits at the time. And I remember, God, this was in the glory days of blogging. And she was doing a read-along for her very first book. And, you know, MP3s, that's back when that was before even podcasting really took off. And I remember she had talked about getting sober. And I thought to myself, if there's this woman who has a PhD, she works in academia, you know, she's still doing research and talking about these really heavy, big topics, and is from the South where, you know, they typically don't. I'm from California, where it's like a little bit more like, okay, you talk about your feelings. And I thought, well, if she can get sober and talk about it, I'm definitely hooked. And so, but if you would have asked me even then, how do you feel about being trained and certified in shame work and then facilitating that, I would have laughed hysterically. I would have been like, absolutely not. Like I created a brand called Your Kick-Ass Life. It was very much, and you know, in all, I will admit it was, those were back in the days of toxic positivity where I'm like, you just need to, you know, pick yourself up, dust yourself off. And as a, you know, proud Gen Xer, like that's how we were raised, the social conditioning of like, this is America, you can do anything. just keep trucking. And so what really pushed me towards it was a couple of things. My own intuition saying, this is the direction you need to go personally, not even professionally yet. And I worked with a lot of women around their negative self-talk. And so after years of doing that, what I kept feeling was the strategies that I was helping them with did work. However, it was like putting a Band-Aid on a gaping, gushing wound. Like you had to just keep putting like new Band-Aids on, and it worked somewhat. Like it was like good enough, but really long term.
It was an improvement.
It was an improvement. But so I'm like, we need to get to the, I'm obsessed with the root of the problem. Like, how do we truly dig deeper and fix this? And so shame resilience began to be the answer. That's really what hooked me. I had no idea also going summer of 2014 was when I went to San Antonio, that it was going to, the way I describe it is, it was as if they flipped me upside down and grabbed me by the ankles and shook me out, like all the loose change that was like shoved deep in my pockets. And the training, they simultaneously had us go through the work as a participant and trained us at the same time. And I realize now that that was by design, to see how resilient we were as facilitators, to see how well we could self-manage. That was the hardest training I've ever done. It was rough.
Yeah. Yeah. Fried fam, I tell you in nearly every episode that step one of your burnout recovery is blood work. And I know that a lot of you avoid it because it's a pain and because your doctor has told you that everything is quote unquote fine. And they refuse to test all the things that you think you need. What if I told you that you could test what you want, when you want, from your home with just a couple of drops of blood? SciFox Health allows you to do just that. You can buy tests as one-offs or join a membership. Either way, you can test and track your results to help you make decisions about your burnout recovery journey. Get 10% off any membership, subscription, or one-time test kit right now. Go to scifoxhealth.com/fried. For your discount. That's scifoxhealth.com/fried. So, there's a lot of people, maybe I'll say this differently. If you've been around here for a long time, you've heard this story before. If you're new, this is your first time hearing this story. This is an incredibly important part of my burnout recovery personally. I was at a spa. I was working, but I was also staying at the spa. My best friend was there with me. I was living in the Czech Republic at the time. She was in Poland, and I would go to this spa and I would treat a friend of ours for a week. And it was just like this whole thing. It was wonderful. And my best friend was with me, and we were in one of those like movie scenes where both of you are laying on the bed, you know, staring at the ceiling. You're not looking at each other, you're head to toe, you know, it's very movie. Like this is a full movie scene. And she said to me, she said, "Kate, you know me better than anyone on the planet. You know everything about me. You have seen all of my scary bits." There were some really rough moments in her life where her husband was calling me and being like, "You need to come here and help me right now." You know, like I've seen her in the absolute pits of everything. And she said, "You know, I don't actually know you that well." And I was like, "What? You know everything about me?" She said, "No, I know your stories. I don't know you at all." There is such a blanket of shame. She said that to me directly. This was in Brené Brown years. Also, this is around 2010, probably 2009, 2010, you know, that kind of thing. It might have been a couple of years after, actually, because I was already in Prague. So 2013. And I stopped, and my initial response was to be angry. I was like, shame? I don't have shame. Because this toxic positivity that I still grew up in, even as a millennial, like, what do I have to be ashamed about? I'm confident, successful person. Like, what are you, shame about what? What should I be? She was like, "Just saying." And it threw me for a very powerful tailspin that ended up helping me, but was really hard to swallow. Just admitting to the fact that I had any shame at all was almost impossible for me, because I was like, well, what does that even feel like? And how does it show up? And what the hell? Where is it? So those are my questions. What is it? Where is it? What does it feel like? WTF?
Where is it? What is it? Well, I want to thank you for sharing that. And that's a new story for me. So I appreciate that. And I want to share this one sort of anecdote that I tell, because I think it's easy for people to see in their own life about how insidious and unconscious, largely unconscious, shame is in our lives, is that when something happens to us, if someone tells me a story and they, so say for instance, I'm sharing the story about, you know, my third book coming out and just, you know, being on a meeting with, you know, the marketing team at the publisher, and they're like, and they say things, because this is really happens. Like they say things like, you know, the numbers aren't as strong as we had wanted them to be. And if I'm sharing that story with you as we are friends, I would probably say, and it was just so embarrassing. But really what's happening is that I felt shame in that moment on the conference call with all of these people on video and them telling me, who's the talent? The numbers aren't as strong as we would have wanted them to be. I am much more than embarrassed. Embarrassment is fleeting. We typically understand that whatever situation we are embarrassed about is common. You know, it happens to everyone. Like if I laugh at really hard and fart at the same time, like at a conference table, like it's embarrassing, like, but I know that it's happened to everyone. Shame is very, you feel like the spotlight is on you and you are the only one in that moment who has ever felt that way. And I say that because we don't even like to put language to it. Because of really just how it is in general, like it survives and impacts us partly because it is a lonely full body experience. So I want to say that from the get-go, even, you know, even if it's for people to recognize times in their lives when they've described something, an experience that they've had, and they describe being embarrassed, you know, and we can get into like the difference between humiliation and guilt and all those things. But I think it's important to start in that place. Like largely shame is an unconscious feeling and experience that we have, is because when it is that way, it's able to do its job better.
And what's its job?
Its job is to keep us small. Its job is to keep us from connecting from other humans. Its job is to keep us in line. So for example, shame gets used a lot in parenting. And, you know, I'm a Gen Xer, and this is not to blame and shame my parents, but it's a parenting tool, and it will change behavior on a dime. You shame a child and it will change their behavior on a dime, but long-term, it is incredibly destructive to their self-worth, to their mental health, to so many things. And so really my point in emphasizing this is that one of the first steps of shame resilience is recognizing how it operates in our lives. Mm. So the more you can maybe even, you know, give this to your audience, like think about times in your life, maybe even recently, where you've told a story and you've said that you were embarrassed. Were you really, or was it something deeper than that? Or were you feeling ashamed? And you can kind of ebb and flow between emotions too. Like it's not, you know,
of course,
just one or the other. And so that's really where we need to start, is the recognizing how it operates in your life. And I want to say one more thing that points to your story, is that I make up that maybe your thought process was something around the lines of, but I don't walk around feeling ashamed. You know, like, what are you talking about? Yeah. And we don't, I don't. But what ends up happening, and this is really why I wrote my second book, I think that's the one that you were reading, is that whenever we are engaging in behaviors that are things like perfectionism, especially numbing out, isolating instead of reaching out to people, a lot of people pleasing and poor boundaries, sometimes overachieving, a lot of times control, these kind of behaviors, what Brené calls the armor, these are the behaviors that we largely employ to try to avoid shame. And if I can just be a little bit more specific, we're doing them to try to avoid criticism. We're trying to avoid judgment. We're trying to avoid blame, because that can lead to shame. And so that was sort of the eye-opener for me in my training of like, oh, all of these behaviors that the women in my audience engage with, me too, by the way, we're doing that in an effort to avoid shame. Therefore, shame is driving the bus of our lives.
Oof.
I know.
Just thinking right now about, I'm a very big reader. I read an awkward amount. Right now, this won't come out for a little while, but it's currently January 24th or 25th, right? 25th.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're 25 days into the new year. I have finished more than 8 books already this year.
Get it, girl.
Right?
Voracious.
Yes. And some of those books are, a lot of them actually, are quick reads, quick beach reads that are like very, you know, super lighthearted and just meant to like, you know, help me pass the time. But what I actually never noticed until this year, that it was that reading has three different functions for me. One of them is like entertainment and relaxation. The second one is it allows me to process. So when I have some like things that I need to figure out in my life, if I can distract myself with like an easy story that I can just follow, then my brain can work out some solutions to problems. Like creative problem solving happens because I'm ADHD. So if I don't like distract myself from it, then I think about it directly. And when I think about it directly, there's too much control and I don't come up with the right solutions, right? Yes. So there's this like percolation function of reading. And what I realized just now, for the first time in my life at 42 years old, after being a burnout specialist for 7 damn years and being an acupuncturist since 2007 and started studying health in the body 5 years before that, after 20 years of working on myself, 24 years of working on myself, I realized that I use reading as a number.
Mm-hmm. Maybe.
I numb out with reading. There's been a lot of big emotional shift in my life recently. And instead of, like you said, instead of reaching out, I isolate. Instead of talking to somebody about what's going on, I open up a beach read and I pretend that I'm, you know, laying in Florida looking at the sky, like, you know?
Yeah.
And so I just noticed that behavior is not always that, but is sometimes that.
Those are the trickiest ones.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you're listening to this, I want you to think about, I do a really good job of choosing coping mechanisms that are socially acceptable.
That are noble.
Yes. Because I'm morally superior.
Contempt.
Which is in and of itself, your ability to choose a coping mechanism that is noble, as you say, that's a good word, is a shame protector.
Sure.
Also, right? Which is like so meta.
It's messy. Mm-hmm. It's messy. And those are the trickiest ones because it's one thing. Like when I got sober, I was drinking a bottle plus of wine a night. And it was very obvious there was this hard line of this is a unhealthy coping. This is an unhealthy coping mechanism. However, some of them are more healthy and noble. But the thing is that only you, like you can't, your therapist isn't going to be able to tell you, Google isn't going to be able to tell you, only you are the one who knows where you are drawing the line. And for me, the question that I ask myself is, because I use social media to numb out.
Yeah.
The question I ask myself, and it's easier for me to come to the answers when I'm going through a really hard time, when something's just acute. And at night when I'm laying in bed, and I am scrolling through social media and the thought of setting my phone down, and I look and I know it's like probably time to shut it down. The thought of setting my phone down and turning out the light and putting my sleep mask on and getting under the covers feels anywhere on the spectrum of scary because I know I have to be alone with my thoughts to be with the darkness that's happening in my life at that moment. Then I know I'm using that to numb out, whether it's reading or whether it's social media or whether it's, you know, flirting with cute men on the internet. Like it could be any of those things, but that's the place that you need to come to for yourself, where you know that you're avoiding the difficult. For me, it's the thoughts. It's just the mind stillness, which is terrifying at times.
Yeah. And I think that we could do this for just about any activity, right? Even if, you know, you allow yourself that, you know, the one glass of wine, but it's every single day and you can't live without it. And you can't, you know, like you can have a glass of wine in a perfectly healthy manner.
Yeah. I think anytime we use the term like trying to take the edge off, I'm always like, well, what's the edge? Like, let's talk about it.
Right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And it can even go as far as, you know, too strict dietary rules, and it can go as far as over-exercising. And so this is, I just want to give everybody, if the first step is just noticing that it's happening somewhere, then these are all different ways that you might notice that it's happening somewhere.
Yeah.
What's step two?
Before we move to step two, I want to say that, like, also, you know, I'm inviting people to think of a story or an experience that they've had in their life where shame hit them like a ton of bricks. And the reason that I ask people to do that is because it's helpful and part of the steps of shame resilience to know what happens to your body when you are in shame in a sort of deeper form than just the kind of trying to avoid shame through perfectionism, et cetera. These are very different things, but they are part of the same quote unquote problem, right? Beast. And so for me, I'll give a quick example. I tell the story in the book. I was at an IEP meeting at one of my children's schools, and they were reading his sort of like health history type of thing at this meeting. And there was a handful of people in the meeting, and they're reading about my child, and then they say, their mother has a history of substance abuse. And then it just like, and then just like kept reading the sentence. And I was like in that moment, and we had just moved to this city. I didn't know these people, these teachers. And I was very eager to make friends. And I had been chatting with one of the teachers ahead of time. She was pregnant and we were talking about that. So, you know, I'm in this place of vulnerability just as a new person, and my child is a new student. And then I immediately went to the place of like, oh my God, like I wanted to interrupt her and defend myself. Like, well, you know, it was just a lot of wine and I've been sober for several years and try to make a joke about it. And so in that moment, my armpits tingled. I immediately felt like my blood sort of ran cold. And I just had that feeling of wanting to change something about the situation, whether I run out the door, never talk to them again, whether I interrupt them. Like it was definitely a moment where time slowed down. And so it's important. And a lot of the symptoms, the physical symptoms, are common within people, but some have their own unique symptoms. So I invite your listeners to think about a time, whether it was in middle school, which Lord knows we all have those moments, or more recently with a partner or at work. And it isn't necessarily where someone has shamed them. Like maybe they made a mistake. Maybe they completely dropped the ball on a meeting or something and didn't show up.
If you're burnt out, you probably did, right? This happens a lot during burnout. Like your productivity goes down. You're not able to show up as you did before. Mm-hmm. You start making mistakes. It's one of the red flag signs, is that you start making mistakes.
Yeah. Which can often lead to shame depending on the situation. And so the invitation is for people to really understand their physiological symptoms that come up when they are in shame. Humiliation typically has the same physical symptoms, but I invite my clients to, and participants when I do group programs, to get very, very familiar, like get in bed with those symptoms so you know when it is happening. Like one of the goals is that you know when you're in it, so that you can become resilient to it. Like that's part of the process. And so the second step is reaching out. And sometimes this isn't possible in the moment. Here's another story. This was from a client who gave me permission to use this story. She had a birthday party for her young daughter, and her daughter was turning 3, and she had a bunch of people over at her house. And my client's mother, she had a complicated relationship with her mother. And my friend, you know, it's a lot of work planning this party, and she gets the birthday cake out and everyone's gathered around the dining room table and they're going to sing happy birthday to her daughter. And she realizes at that moment that she forgot to buy candles, birthday candles. And so my client's mother says to her out loud in front of everybody, "What kind of mother forgets candles on their daughter's birthday?" Like in a joking tone, but my client knew exactly what that was. And so we had been working on shame resilience through our work together, and she wasn't able to at the moment. She had to go through the motions of figuring out. I think she ended up getting like a candlestick and sticking it in the cake. But later on, she locked herself in the bathroom and called one of her best friends who was in another state and cried on the phone and told her exactly, not just what happened, not just the stories, like you were talking about when you shared your story, but what the emotional experience was like. That's what we're talking about when we're talking about vulnerability and reaching out. And if your listeners are familiar with Brené Brown, they've probably heard one of her most famous sayings is, share people with people who've earned the right to hear your story. So, and this is, you know, can be complicated, but it's, these are people that you trust, where you've established mutual trust, and that they will hear your story and truly hear it without trying to fix it, without trying to be dismissive. And like, you have a great kind of rapport and relationship already, but it's just saying out loud what the experience was like for you is a way to go through the shame resilience process. Because the other option is just to keep it inside, you know, tell yourself like, it really wasn't that big of a deal. My mom's a CUNT, like just, you know, I'm overreacting, like those types of things that we tell ourselves to try to feel better, yeah, that don't end up working.
Well, and people say that all the time in the Facebook group, like, how can I have this emotion less? And I'm like, well, that's not really mm-hmm. how it works. Mm-hmm. That's yeah. not really like an option. And this to me, for a lot of people in this community and for myself, there isn't a person that we trust. And there isn't a person that we trust, really, because we have never told those stories and offered people the possibility of really, truly showing up.
Yeah.
I never offered people the possibility of really and truly showing up because I thought that I was the one that was supposed to show up for people. I wasn't the one that got showed up for. I was the shower upper. Mm-hmm. That was my role. And if I didn't play that role all the time, I was not worthy of love or affection right. or attention, or did, and I did not hold any value. This mm-hmm. is something that I'm still unwinding. I have a friend right now who we're like getting closer over time, and she keeps saying, will you please call me and lean on me? And I say, I don't know how, right? There are, I do have people in my life that I can use in this way now, but up until this moment that Eva pointed this out to me, I was like 35. Mm-hmm. You know, I was over 30 when this happened.
Yeah. We don't know how to do this. Like, we're not taught how to do this.
So if you are listening to this and you're like, well, I don't have anybody I can talk to like that. In order to have someone you can talk to like that, you have to risk talking to someone like that in the first yeah. place, which is really scary. And it might help to preamble the conversation to say, I am not looking for feedback. This is something that I mm-hmm. tell you to practice in the Facebook group as well. If you just want to vent, you must state at the top of your post, mm-hmm. this is just a vent. I do not want advice. You are allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm. All caps. Right? Yeah.
All caps. Yeah. You can put it in bold if you want. Header number one, big yeah. letters, fine by me. You are allowed to do that. And I think that this ability to let someone hold space for you is one that we all need to practice. And maybe I just say that because I still need to practice it. It's not an automatic thing for me. It's something that I have to think about and consider. Like I said, we're going through a lot in my household recently, and somebody said, well, just call me if you need something. And I was like, well, what could I possibly need?
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
You need? Can provide me. Yeah.
You know, like, what do you mean need something?
Do you have a magic potion? You know,
I'll take two.
Like, are you a wizard? Uh-huh. Because what are you talking about? And then I had to laugh at myself. This is what I teach people all the time. Mm-hmm. But I still get stuck in this system the same way that everybody else does. So if you just listened to that step two and you thought, I don't have anybody, I want you to think up the top one or two people that popped up on your list when Andrea was telling that story and call them and tell them, listen, within the next couple of weeks, I'm going to call you and tell you a story. And I want you to just listen to me and I don't want you to fix it. I'm practicing trust. Baby like steps. Just mm-hmm. tell them that it's coming yeah. so that you can build a foundation and prep for it. This is about practice and about taking that step. But people cannot hold space for you if you give them nothing to hold.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you're pausing here because, and there's a whole module on, there's actually two modules on this in the whole Shame Resilience program. It's called The Daring Way. And it's I think it's so incredibly hard to make adult friendships. Yeah. And I don't think it's gender specific. Like, I think it just for adults in general, when we don't have built-in systems. I also think that I remember when I was going through like the hardest time when, you know, I had those two back-to-back relationships and I was pregnant and knew I was going to be a single mom and just did not know which way was up and had so much trauma. What I got met with over and over again was people telling me, "Oh, Andrea, you are so strong to get through this. Like Kate's laughing right now. Like, I don't know what I would do if I were you. Like, I'm just so impressed with how you're handling all of this." And I'm like, I'm not, you know, and I didn't have the words, but like what I would have given in that moment to have someone say, if you need to fall apart all over the floor and not be okay, because I can't imagine how you're okay in this moment. If you need somebody, I will be here to hold you while you just cry your GD face off. That, as the receiver of that, I think that is the most vulnerable. Like, I would rather run naked through Times Square than have someone hold space for me while I show you the darkest and what I deem ugliest parts of me. I also find it an incredible honor. Like, this part makes me emotional.
To do it.
To be the person who someone trusts me enough, excuse me, to walk through that with them. Like, there is no greater honor. To me, it's like being in the room with someone when they give birth. Like,
it is.
Experience that. It's, I think, the ultimate human connection.
If this was intriguing to you, I want you to go back and find the episode with Jess Brennan, whose entire massage practice is built around holding space for people's grief and shame and literally holding people while they fall apart. Her massage practice is in Montclair, New Jersey. It's called Held, literally, because this is exactly what she does, because she was going through a divorce and she needed, somebody actually did this for her. And she thought, well, this is the only thing that actually truly helped me. How do I provide this service for other people? And so there's an entire episode about that. And so we're talking about shame here, but this also works for grief. And it also works for, you know, like, this is just allowing somebody to hold space for you. It's also why coaching containers are so sacred.
Yeah. Yeah. I think as women, like, even though we are stereotypically the more quote unquote emotional gender, I do think that, and the research shows that our biggest shame trigger tends to be our appearance. Mm. And what is directly related to that was, you know, how we show up in situations, like how put together we are and how we are able to handle all of the plates that are spinning in our lives. And so to fall apart, you know, it's like, don't get me started on the stereotype of hysteria. Yeah. It's incredibly vulnerable. So yeah, that's part of it. And then also self-compassion is sort of like the other side of the coin in a common humanity of understanding that everyone deals with this, because when we're in shame, it can feel very isolating and lonely. Like, no one else feels this way. I'm the only, you know, insert derogatory description. I'm stupid, dumb, all of those things.
I'm never going to figure this out. I should be stronger than this. I should be better than this.
I should be farther along, all of those things. Yeah. And so having self-compassion and talking to yourself with kindness is also part of that step of shame resilience.
So if you need more, how the hell do I be self-compassionate? Dr. Kristen Neff, the number one researcher in the world on self-compassion, also has a Fried podcast episode, which you can go back and listen to. It's really powerful. I suggest it. I will throw those links in these show notes if I remember, because sometimes I do and sometimes I don't.
Her work is heavily cited in this program.
Yes. Yeah. Because she's just
her. Guru.
Yeah. She's the person. All right. So we have step one, admit to it at all. Notice it's there.
Notice it's there.
Start paying attention to how it shows up. Know what it feels like. Step two, share it with someone.
Empathy and self-compassion.
Mm-hmm. Empathy and self-compassion and connection.
Yes.
Right? It's because it's about not allowing it to be, as Brené Brown always says, like, once you flash the light on it, it can't, it like thrives in the dark like mold, you know, like once you flash the light on it, it eases. So that's step one and step two. What comes next?
Step three is what they call practicing critical awareness. And this is like for any of my people who love, you know, heady, which is most of us.
Every single person on this podcast was like, yeah, Screw the emotional sensations. Yeah. Let's get to the part I can do in my head.
Critical awareness. And it's really just sort of zooming out on the entire situation, because I think we can get very zoomed in. And also, what I tell my clients is be careful here, because we can start to over-identify and want to label everything. Well, is this shame? Is this a behavior? Is this a numbing out mechanism? And just take care of yourself during those times, because I think we can get caught up in that as a way to avoid feeling and experiencing. And so it's just mindfulness. It's just paying attention. So it's things like, you know, paying attention when you are in a room with people and you're feeling uncomfortable because you're massively underdressed. It's just seeing when you have a physical symptom, like, oh, I've got tunnel vision right there all of a sudden. Like maybe shame was creeping in and you didn't know it. So it's part of the process of making sure that you are, I prefer the term paying attention versus mindful, just because it allows me to not, I think, overthink. But yeah, it's pretty basic. Step three, practicing critical awareness.
So step one is necessary because you need to sort of admit to it and notice that it's happening. Mm-hmm. Then you need to reach out to somebody. And then you just need to sort of continue step one, but in a more alert way, because you've already admitted to it and you already know it's happening. So now you're just sort of like keeping the flashlight going, making sure that you're seeing things when they pop up. But that doesn't mean, like you said, overanalyzing every situation. Right. It just means paying attention and watching what things are going on. You'll notice new patterns. You'll notice new things.
Yeah.
You know, just keep your eyes open.
Just keep your eyes open and be kind to yourself along the way. And then the fourth step is what they call, and by they, I mean Brené and her senior faculty who have named these steps, speaking shame. And so that means having conversations like you and I are having right now. So for your listeners, it might be telling someone that I listened to this conversation, this podcast, and they were talking about this, and just talking about it. You know, like we can talk about joy, like we can talk about
gratitude,
depression.
My favorite.
Exactly. I know. It just, shame is just another human emotion and experience. It is, you know, shame and vulnerability are up there. You know, I love that Brené calls them full contact emotions. They are very physical. But so can joy can be that way as well. You know, pleasure can be that way as well. And it's just another one that is in that same category. So I think the thing that has helped me so much become more resilient to it is having the conversation. So you are pulling that out of the closet. And just, you know, I hate to mix my metaphors here, but the elephant in the room has been called out and we are dressing it up. We're inviting it to tea. So that's the fourth step of speaking shame, because then it just becomes part of your vernacular. It becomes part of your just whole experience in your emotions as you're, you know, walking through, whether it's your burnout recovery or just your life, where it's just a part of your human experience. And then it can create less of an impact.
And you assume that it's also a part of everyone's human experience.
Yeah.
Like when you're talking about, right? Like it makes it about more than just you. So it's interesting to me because it sounds like step three and four are sort of repetitions of step one and two, but at a different level of awareness and sharing.
A little bit. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Makes it easier.
Yeah. If I had to kind of like break it down into steps, like to summarize for people, it really is about, again, first and foremost, understanding how it operates in your life. And there's a whole module that I take people through, which is one of my favorites, around your triggers and identities, which is hugely part of step one, understanding how it operates. And then, you know, when you're in it, it's the empathy and self-compassion. It's the then critical awareness around, like even things like what happens when I shame myself all on my own, what happens when someone does it purposefully, that's one way to see it, or they do it accidentally, because many people, we shame people without even knowing, because people have their own triggers that sometimes we don't know. And then again, the conversation around just making it more of a part of your life. And I want to say this because just in case anyone is thinking it, there's no way to eradicate this in your life. The only people that we know who don't experience shame are you know, sociopaths and psychopaths. And even I think the research is still being looked at on there, but the people who don't have the human capacity for empathy and connection, which is a very small percentage of the population from what I understand, but the vast majority of us have capacity for these types of feelings and all experience shame pretty regularly.
Yeah, it just needs to be a bigger part of the conversation.
Mm-hmm. Still uncomfortable.
Still uncomfortable.
Yikes. Yeah, not a fan.
Don't like
Zero
it.
Stars.
This goes back to a concept that we talk about on the podcast a lot, because you know that my favorite emotion is resentment, and it does so many good things in your life. And I think that it goes back to this Chinese medicine concept that we hone in on a lot here of there's no such thing as a negative emotion. Mm-hmm. There are only emotions that become harmful when they are unnoticed, ignored, not processed, not transformed.
I totally agree with that. I often like chime in when someone refers to an emotion as negative, and I'm like, I just consider them impactful.
They all make an impact, but you have to go through the whole process of them.
Yeah.
If you're not paying attention to them, if you don't notice them, if you refuse to see them, if you ignore them, if you shove them down, if you push them aside, they will pile up in your body. They will add to your baseline stress level. They will add to your vulnerability to health problems. They just will.
Yeah.
So having a process for some of the more difficult ones, we have a process for shame that Andrea shared here. You have a process for resentment with the Resentment Journal mini course. We are giving you tools to finally, as a 45-year-old woman, look at the things that you haven't known what to do with for the majority of your life.
Mm-hmm.
It creates so much freedom to be able to do this. So thank you so much for sharing those steps. They are useful and powerful, and I'm into it. What all sort of final words? Do you have a parting idea that's floating around in your brain?
Yeah.
That you feel like you need to say before we wrap up?
I think I want to remind people that this work is never linear. Mm-hmm. I've been trained and certified in this work for almost 10 years, and it still sneaks up on me where I'm like, whoa, when did you get here? You know, it's been in the back seat for weeks. And I want to emphasize how much self-compassion comes in handy for all of that. And definitely, if you are feeling sad because you don't have the people in your life that we talked about that can hold you in those places, maybe that's a place to start. And I agree with you of just like having the conversation of, you know, prefacing the conversation, and also maybe reaching out to some people who you've lost touch with, but you think they have potential to be what we call your marble jar friend. There's a whole metaphor with that. But it's vulnerable. I understand it's vulnerable, but definitely worth it.
Definitely worth it. Andrea, how do people find you, find your books, get into your courses, get you as a coach, all the things?
Probably my website, andreaowen.com. I'll just send them to one place because they have a lot of information right now. And I don't want to shoot people in a lot of directions.
And they're burnt out brains.
Andreaowen.com.
Simple enough. Andrea, yeah. Thank you so much for being here. Fried fam. You know that it is always my goal in every single episode to create a moment of transformation for you, a moment of healing for you, a moment of resonance for you. When things are too big, when there's a lot, you are allowed to choose just one miniature piece that you can manage moving forward. What I would like to know this week in the Facebook group is, what miniature piece are you choosing from this episode? Because I think if we talk about this more in the group, then that will help more and more people start to unwind this in their own lives. So that's what I'll be looking for. Can't wait to see what your feedback is. And we'll be back with a new Burnout Church sermon in a week. See you then.
Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Ain't gonna burn ourselves out no more. Got each other on our side, plus all the folks at Fried, the Burnout Podcast with Kate Donovan.